Your mother is being raped in the backyard, your father hanging from his guts in the front yard, while you are locked inside your home with an American flag draped upon the walls and a television blaring 24 hours a day. You are free.
F off back to Russia. 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 F off back to Russia.
Into Pandemonium, a public affairs program from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium. An apocalypse is an event on a grand scale, a catastrophe that affects our lives indelibly. It is also a story that, judging from the sheer volume of them that we tell, alone and together, has a definite ending, the details of which we are rather concerned with. What is it about the current day that so often casts our focus onto apocalypse and the events that follow it? Is there a background noise of sublime terror, a raging storm, or news of permanent collapse pervading our lives, driving political conflict, justifying ever greater engineering of social order? And is this disaster specific to us, or has it always been present throughout the ages? In first seeking the center of the apocalypse, I sat down with Ben Knight, a Berlin-based filmmaker, and asked him about the movie he just made.
Okay, so it is called We're All Going to Die, and it is about people who are preparing in one way or another for catastrophe. And it kind of moves through different types of preparation. So it begins with your standard prepper type person who would be like hoarding food and maybe learning new skills and figuring out how to, you know, use radios again, and rather than cell phones, just preppers, and then sort of talking about how they their kind of disappointment with the way everyone else is just carrying on their day, and they have to think about all these terrible things that are going to happen. So that's the kind of the beginning of it. Anyway, so I met a couple of preppers, and then it kind of moves into a more climate grief is a big thing now amongst a lot of people, and it has been for quite a while. And I met a couple of people in the States who went through a profound grief 20 years ago because they felt like this economic and social system was totally unsustainable. And so he's called Guy McPherson. He went and 20 years ago he felt like, you know, this isn't going to work. No, and he went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico. He was a tenured professor, and he gave up his job and went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico and learned how to make cheese. And then he realized that there was another thing that meant that even if somehow humans prevented the burning of fossil fuels overheating the earth, because of what he calls the aerosol dimming effect, the pollution would actually shields us from the worst heat of the sun. So even if we reduced pollution, we would be fried too. So he then realized that we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, and decided that he couldn't be bothered to live on a homestead anymore, and now he just lives in a normal house and gives interviews and does podcasts and things like that. And and he calls himself an educator. I mean, he's like an odd fellow, because he kind of, what was interesting about him for me was because he went through this period of profound despair and grief, and what he thought was that the futility of trying to continue. And then he came out of the other side of it and said, well, look, you know, we're all going to die, so there's nothing anyone else could do about it, so I might as well just live the best life I can the way I want to live and not worry about anything. And that's what he does now. Do I feel that daily life has given over to chaos? No, I feel like what is surprising about the current situation is that everyone is carrying on as normal to and basically shutting out the chaos as much as they can, and finding ways to distract each other. I mean, there's always like an initial shock moment, as it happened when, especially if you live in Europe, when Russia just invaded Ukraine, for example. But then after a few days, and you know, we have like thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees, you started noticing that people were posting their Wordle scores on Twitter again, which they had been doing, you know, quite regularly up until that moment. And then there was about a week where people stopped doing it, and then they kind of put them back. So I think there's a natural human tendency to avoid chaos at all costs. If people get used to things, don't they? People get, it's surprising how quickly people get used to disaster scenarios and learn to cope. I mean, I was reading, I mean, just to get back to the same example again, but I was reading reports now of people in Kiev and how, you know, they want to open the schools again in Kiev tomorrow. They want to do online schooling again, which is like crazy when you think about, you know, that the Russian army is 20, 25 kilometers away from the city center still. Well, first thing was that someone told me that they were going to go to Mexico anyway, and I thought, oh, that would be cool to go to Mexico. And then I thought, and then I remembered that in Mexico, it's the site of the center of the Chicxulub crater, which is the crater that was caused by the asteroid that killed all the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. And I kind of thought it would be, you know, what better place to sort of conclude the film, but at the site of a catastrophe that almost wiped out all life on Earth, and one of the five great big mass extinction events that have happened, the last one that has happened throughout in our history. And so I had this sort of vision of filming at this, because I knew there was a little monument there. There's a little memorial to the dinosaurs in this town, and it's a town on the northern coast of Yucatan, on the Yucatan, in the Yucatan Peninsula, a sort of coastal town. But the crater itself is 100 miles across, so you obviously can't see it, and it is also about a kilometer underground. And they only really found out that it was there in the 1980s, and so yeah, I just thought I'd, but then when they did find it, the little town, and it's a kind of like a, there's nothing really in the town. It's like a beach resort, but not a particularly fancy one. There are no big hotels there, but they do have a little monument to the dinosaurs, which I thought was quite poignant. So I wanted to film there, and so I did a little thing where I stood next to the monument and spoke to the camera about my feelings about why I wanted to film a scene there, and why, you know, why I saw that point as a kind of the starting point for the film, even though it was right at the end of filming. Yeah, so that was one reason. Oh, the other thing was that there's a lot of Mayan people still around there, and people often think of the Mayan civilization as a civilization that collapsed. So I was quite interested in that too. So I interviewed a few Mayan people. I mean, most of the people in that region are still have Mayan heritage. So that was pretty interesting. And rather than a cycle, I would think of it as concentric circles, that we're always kind of living in a space that has been created by a past disaster, that we are never really. The destruction of all the dinosaurs was what was the event that made our evolution possible. You know, I mean, it's getting a bit, like, obviously a bit esoteric now, but the idea is that we're always living in the aftermath of another disaster, and that disaster is what made our lives even possible. So I wanted it, I wanted kind of the end of the film, I want people to kind of make peace with the idea of apocalypse, make peace with the idea of collapse and destruction, because after all, our own lives depend on someone else's apocalypse and other creatures' extinction, you know. And so I kind of like I see it as sort of, yeah, like we're always in a way, our whole we're always inside the crater of an asteroid that crushed the people that came before us, or the dinosaurs that came before us. A lot of people feel a lot of anxiety at the moment, and especially now because of the war, but also because of a lot of people feel a lot of anxiety about climate change, and a lot of people feel general anxiety about, you know, pandemics. People just worry about the future. It's part of our nature to worry about the future, and people want to feel safe, and none of us really are ever safe, and something like the threat of nuclear war kind of really brings that home, you know. I meet an Indian author who's written quite a lot about climate change called Amitav Ghosh, and then he kind of says, well, what's interesting for me about all this is that it's not like I don't worry about the future either, because for people from my part of the world, he comes from Bangladesh and India, and people from the colonized parts of the world, they've already been through their own destructive apocalypse, and now they're still alive, you know, and they still survive and they still thrive in many ways. And he says what he sees is basically this anxiety about the future is a kind of is just like our part of the world, the Western part of the world, realizing that it is losing its power. You know, like apparently in grief, like when psychologists talk about grief, there's a thing where if you've got a parent or a grandparent who is dying, and you know that they're going to die, people start to grieve in advance, you know, or especially if they have dementia, you can see them, like, their faculties shutting down one by one, and people who are watching their loved ones die like that, they go through this kind of pre-grief. And there are these therapists and psychoanalysts and psychologists who say that this is what a lot of people are feeling now about the earth itself, or about the society itself. They're feeling this kind of, they're going through this kind of pre-grief for something that is dying. But yeah, there's a nostalgia, there's a loss. We've lost our innocence, and in a weird way, they kind of want the apocalypse to happen so that we regain that innocence. You know, it's a very Christian thing, isn't it? It's like we gave up paradise, so now we have to somehow get back to it through a major disaster, and that would like there would be like a purge. It would be like Noah's flood, and then we would get back to our lost innocence. I think a lot of people would say that but probably that's not how it'll pan out, because as you say, we will have certain technologies that we could probably still use for a while anyway. I mean, yeah, depends how long your generator's going to run. I mean, a lot of the preppers that I know are actually, even though they don't believe in climate change, or the ones that I met didn't, they actually hate the Green Party and the Green movement in general. They actually are quite ecologically better prepared than most people, because they have invested in solar panels, because they do think that the power grid is not sustainable. So they have invested in having in like local solar panels, which is this one guy I know in Cologne, who who, yeah, he's extremely skeptical of the climate movement, but he does have he is what do you call it, autonomous from the power grid. I think it would be like the idea that hope is treacherous. I think a lot of these people, a lot of these people, look at the way that normal people, I'd say normal people, but everyone is feels like that we have to, basically we everyone is like hoping that, you know, like Putin doesn't launch his nuclear weapons, or hoping that we prevent the worst excesses of climate change, or hoping that that you know, society won't collapse and that we'll find some way, we'll keep it together in one way or another. And they see this hope as a delusional thing. And he said, and one guy McPherson, in fact, he said, I said to him, but surely he's, I he because he wrote in one of his books, he wrote like, we should give up hope, like is hope is a is a is a is this treacherous thing. And I said, but surely the opposite of hope is despair, you know, surely the, and he goes, no, he was like, he like, if he would have slapped his thigh if he could have done, but he was like, no, it's not the, why are you saying that, you know, that's not the tr that, that's not true at all. And then I said, okay, so what is the opposite of hope? And he said, I say the opposite of hope is taking action, is a sort of taking responsibility for your life, or trying to change something. If you really, really do worry about these things, if you are extremely anxious about the future, then hope isn't going to help you. What's going to help you is figuring out how you are going to deal with it and facing it. And I suppose that's what stuck with me, was this sort of this, and that can be practical. It can be like, you know, do what a prepper does and find a bunker in the forest and put us fill it with food, or it can be, you know, joining a climate protest or something. It can be like whatever you do. It can, or it can just be facing up to this, your general anxiety, and figuring out, okay, or because we are all going to die. So what are you going to do with the time you have left? You know, what is valuable to you? And I think that that is sort of the profound thing, is that, you know, we should like this idea that, yeah, this idea that it will all be okay in the end, is a treacherous idea, and that in fact it should be okay now, and all you can really control is this is how you cope with your life. What we're facing is, everybody goes, oh, we're all going to die, yeah. But then we are all going to die. Like that's the one immutable fact of human existence, is that is that it will end, you know? And fully realizing that is, I think, as I think it's an Achilles in Homer. Doesn't he say everything is more beautiful because we're doomed, and the gods envy us for our mortality, you know, like he say something like
Yeah,
that.
for
So
sure.
I think the idea of it is that, you know, we can everything is more beautiful because we're all going to die, you know, because of our mortality, and the gods envy us, the gods, the immortal gods envy us because of that. So I guess it's so what I'm saying is that this sort of fear of the apocalypse is actually just a, is just a facing up to the sort of the human condition, in a very normal way, because, you know, yeah.
A man who has made a more specific, a metaphysical study of apocalypse, through how life should be lived at all times and in all places, is Orthodox rabbinical figure Chad Whitaker of Pittsburgh. I put him to the question in a dark cavern.
People are constantly bringing some sort of post-apocalyptic scenario to bear to, as like an exercise in like some sort of existential threat. And, okay. And perhaps the closer we get to feeling that there's some sort of accelerando in our lifetimes, it was wars in the past, and now obviously what we're looking at is...
Yeah, more wars, even like heightened. It is a crescendo. Maybe, but here's the thing. All right, so fundamentally, I don't know, right? Like, fundamentally, I don't know. Right. Like, logically, I can picture some scenarios. It's like, I can imagine an existential threat materializing. Like, I can imagine more easily now than last month, right? Like, a nuclear holocaust materializing, right? Or I can imagine an existential threat not materializing and universal paperclips and, like, you know, humanity expanding out into the galaxy or whatever, right? Like, you know, I can imagine Isaac Asimov, last story, sort of like cyclic, like, you know, the boom and bust and the, like, the on universal scales and, like, all of this, right? Like, anything logically imaginable is imaginable, okay? And God's outside of all of it, and God's doing whatever he wants, and there's these fundamental patterns of ordering, of hierarchy, of structure, you know, of structures of beauty, of these abstractions, of these hierarchical structures, like those are kind of circling back around to like this little apocalypse. Like, I really only need to care about what's in front of me. What's, like, what's in my sphere of influence, you know? Well, how about everything else? It's like, well, I don't know. I'm not everything else. Right. Like, I'm me, right. You know? Like, here's what I have to deal with right in front of me.
In terms of that existential threat, though, I think we're always presented with some extraordinarily grim, dark, bleak, like The Road, or Nathan was talking about The Stand earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I guess just like, what do we do in the face of that? What do we do, you know, rationally with a study of history, with a study of, you know, you have this theological framework.
But man, we had apocalypse in the last century. Like, look at Russia last century, you know? Like, look at the utter upheaval of civilization and, like, you know, the Communist Revolution and Stalin and the Gulag and, like, you know, which is like reverberating through our present day, right? Like this, like these tumultuous, or the, like the Polish Jew, right? Like the, like Holocaust, like they're, like we witnessed in the 20th century, you know, almost as much apocalypse as one could want, let's say, you know, short of an existential crisis, short of an existential threat materializing. It's like these were, and then, but then what do individual people do with these, right? Like, there's a book called Father Arseny, there's a biography of this priest named Father Arseny, you know, who was an amazing saint in the Gulag and, like, kept the flame alive, you know, like, it was, like, a real life... Well, you referenced The Road, right? And, like that's fiction, okay? Like, keeping the light alive, like, gotta keep the light alive. Like, this guy kept the light alive in the Gulag for decades, you know? And, like, when you're a person, you know, like,
right.
When you're a person, like, he couldn't... He wasn't in control of the sweep of history. You know, he wasn't... he's a grain of sand in the ground in the wheels of history, right? And what? And he... he did well with what he had, you know, and like what more could any of us hope to do than to do well with what's God has given us in our sphere of influence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, raise your son as well as you can. Love your neighbors as well as you can. Like, I don't want to do it out of fear. If I'm going to prepare for an apocalypse, like, there's, like, the apocalypse choosing not to try to love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And I tasted choosing not to try, and that is what terrifies me. That's what terrifies me.
I am telling myself the story of my life, stranger and song of fiction. We start with the joyful mysteries before the appearance of ether, trying to capture the elusive. The farm where the crippled horses heal, the woods where autumn is reversed, and the longing for bliss in the arms of some beloved from the past. I said, "Your daddy loves you." I said, "Your daddy loves you very much. He just doesn't want to live with us anymore."
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
listening to Aggregate Sound with DJ Next Page, WRCT Pittsburgh.
Thank you. organized, as we can see, right? It's usually because you're so caught up in the past, am I right? Right? You're more caught up in the past, so you're very depressed. If it is that you're very anxious, right, it seems that you're very much, you know, futuristic too much. You're probably too connected with the future. So you are not present enough to process things in a balanced and even wavelength.
Fake smiling through the bush, yeah, that's a basic. Me on the phone, yeah, you know I've been evasive. Turn a mean mug to a grand for the payslip. Yeah, ain't felt pain till you roll it in a tray flip. No tears, everything, I've only got a main bitch. But I've got an itch, finna catch it if you pitch. Most days on my mind, on the sofa blowing piff. I'm a realist, I don't see nothing else as real as this a purist. Only drug talks from the purest, the tourist. Ain't no free smoke, get smoked by the chorus. And we lost hope, up, down, got me looking so gorgeous. And I pull up with the gang, ski, ski. All these moving herds like sheep, bleat, bleat. See coyote on them wheels, fast like me, me. Foreign whip, side full speed, beep, beep. Make some noise on the strip. 145 brick lane and we there. Nike Air Max on my feet with a swish. Run up on the game and my name hit a lick.
I'm a mother boss, catch me lighting my they keep on trying to snooze. My killer's dying to shoot too. K on my boots, wanna me in a suit. But I'm all about the shiny, so I gotta recoup. Got him feeling like a child when I take him to the mood. I'm not rude, I'm not rude, I'm not rude. Call my kitty holiday, come when he leave, he get the blues. Glitter like it's gold, but my lipstick's nude. Hungry brothers wanna eat me like some food, I refuse. Turn up with my girls, where the booze, don't pee. Great news, got the rum, more approved. Got the trees, got the roots, got the fruit, got the juice. White girls love the Charlie cause I'm fire in the booze.
Don't play me for a fool. I'd rather be alone. I'm next to someone. feels comfortable. Don't play me for a fool. I'd rather be alone than be next to someone.
the past behind. No way, shadows dancing from the smoke. Get up, got a soldier moving forward. Go up in the blazes. Your heart is softer, fire and bolder. Go up in the blazes. 'Cause I can't stand to live this way. So once I've gone, I'm gone, okay. Your heart is softer, fire and bolder. Go up in the blazes.
It's the DRE. Steel. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Dr. Dre be the name, still running the game, still. It's the DRE, yeah. Still, it's the DRE. Still, it's the DRE, yeah. Still, it's the DRE. Dr. Dre be the name, still running the game, still. Still, it's the DRE. Still, it's the DRE. Still, it's the DRE. It's the DRE.
WRCT Pittsburgh.